Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Evening, friends. My name's Doug, and I'm an alcoholic. Talk about miracles are still happening today. By me standing up here sober, that is a miracle in itself. And the best way for me to explain that miracle is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What happened? I drank too much. But I think a little bit of history about myself is I come from a family of seven. There were two boys and a girl, and then a boy. And in those days, there were no sonars that they had a look to see what was who and how and what. And I think my parents had two boys, a girl, and a boy. And number five, that was me. They were convinced that it was going to be a little girl. They were definitely convinced of that. And I need to tell you this because it affected my life, seriously. And I only found out when I was about 3 and a half, they had a name for this little girl that was supposed to be born. And I was born on a Sunday because to find a name, they looked in the newspaper. And the little girl was supposed to be called Claire. And we lived on a farm. And it was a great event when visitors came. And the kids had to go and play outside, and my mother was telling them about. Doug, we were really expected a girl. And it was a little boy. You know, this little girl arrived with a little thing. But how it affected that little boy, I was not what my parents wanted. And when they had number six, and number six was a girl, and they were so disappointed that I wasn't the little girl, they didn't call that one Claire. They called her Jeannie. And that affected me quite seriously. And instead of going and lying and feeling sorry for myself, I made up my mind that I would be better than any little Claire or girl that they could ever have had. And only now do I realize that I set myself up for failure. I was going to be the best that they could ever have. I just drove myself. I was not what they wanted, and I sort of, in my mind, and my mother and father loved me dearly, and my brothers and sisters did, but I didn't. I think the big problem was that I didn't love myself. And I had to be the best at school. I had to be the best at sport. And I had to drive myself immensely. Somehow God had gifted me with a brain, and I managed. And I can remember the first time I drank. I was about 14. And I brought a friend from school. I went to school here in Petersburg, and I grew up in a little town called Dalstrom. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. And this guy came. He was a Joburg jawler. So he could drink and he could do this and that. And my mother had the booze there. And old Patrick came and suggested we go and steal the booze. And we steal and drank. And I now realize I drank alcoholically from the first day. We must have had curry and rice or something because, I got ill, and with curry and rice all over the wall and everything. And he was telling me, now listen, just lie down, put your foot on the, out of the bed, and the room will stop spinning. It didn't stop spinning. And the next time I drank, I must have been about 16 in grade 12 matric. And I was doing French. There were only four of us who did French in matric at that time. The others had all finished before. They did economics or something. And they were going to celebrate. And they went to a chap's house in town, Michael Choate, and we were drinking. And I ended up lying on my stomach, fertilizing the rose bushes. And I felt terrible the next day, and I had to go and apologize for the way that I had behaved. And so the two occasions that I could think of drinking as a child or a young person, I drank and I got drunk. In high school, sort of a memory it comes that nobody could want to be my friend. Because if they knew what I was like, nobody would want to be my friend. So I became a people pleaser. I did things for people. They could only like me for what I did for them. They could copy my homework. I would just do things. That is how I had my friends. And if they really found out who I was, they wouldn't like me. And I think that also, in a sense, drove me to choose the kind of life that my vocation in life. I became a brother of charity, possibly because I could do things for people, and that's why they would like me. And in 73, I was very, very young, and if anybody came to me wanting to become a brother at that age, I mean, I don't even think I could pee straight at the time when I wanted to join the brothers. And I'll tell them, go out and experience some life before you come back. I didn't drink during my novitiate. I was too afraid of what they would say, and I went through my year's training not drinking, and I was then sent to the Northwest, into a town in the Northwest, and I taught. And I was teaching. I was told not to tell anybody how old I was, and I think the brothers were a bit afraid to send me to go and study in case I wasn't going to be a good teacher. So I had to teach for 3 years to prove that I could do it before they sent me to university. And I can remember I celebrated all the events, and the Jewish children I had, they had the special Jewish wine, and it was very, very sweet. And they brought this wine, and put it in my habit pocket and went upstairs and drank the sweet stuff. And I was very strong. I was then sent to university, and I went to Stellenbosch, and I did a BSc. And one of my subjects was chemistry. And in my first year, and there was a chap from Zimbabwe who was studying with me, he also did chemistry. And we decided we would brew our own booze. And we were staying in a prefab house that had a number of showers, and there were three of us, but there were six or something showers, and if you came into the prefab, you'd hear, pop, pop, pop. And we fermented and made our own beer. And we couldn't keep it in these little dumpies because it would blow them. We re-fermented it twice, and we took it to the chemist in town, and he measured the alcohol content. It was 13 point something. Black Label is 5 or something. So we would have, and it was quarts, and we would have these quarts, and it would kick like a donkey. Boy, and these would knock me out. And if I drank these, I just didn't study. So I tried to avoid drinking, and because I was too terrified to fail. I had to get through. And I lived with the Irishmen, yes, but those Irish could drink. And I lived with these Irish guys, and they were telling me, you're too serious, have a social life at varsity, you study, study, study. And, we're going to take you out. And I thought, I can't drink. And in those days, in South Africa, I thought, nothing would be open on a Sunday where you could buy booze. So I said, and they wanted to take me out for supper. Right, we'll go out for supper on a Sunday night. And we ended up in the Pig and Whistle in Cape Town. And, I don't dance very well. I have the rhythm. I don't have the rhythm. Give me one or two whiskies and I become a dancing teacher. That is what it does to me. It just changes me. I can remember it was crowded, and there was this Irish music playing, and there was an atmosphere, and I was drinking. We ended up in front of the toilets, the woman's toilets. And I was sitting on a bar stool, and there was a bar stool across there. And now we are brothers going out with these Irishmen. I was the only brother of charity, and these women had to get to the toilet. And I mean, alcohol made me do things that I would never, ever have done. My foot would go out, toll gate, before they could get to the loo. You either have to give me some money or give me a kiss before you could get into the loo. And I mean, and we had to go back to Stellenbosch. And all I can remember was rolling around in the back of this combi and hurling and stopping the vehicle to get sick. And the next day I felt absolutely green. All I wanted was black tea and dry toast. That's how sick I felt. And I vowed I would never drink again because I would not make varsity, not get through it. Anyway, I managed to get through and passed quite well, and I came back to the Northwest to teach. And if you worked as hard as I did, and you lived with the brothers that I did, I mean, you'd hear people say, if you had the wife that I had, you would also drink. If you lived with the brothers that I lived with, you would also drink. They were from overseas. They didn't understand South Africans. They wanted me to wear sandals with socks. And I mean, all sorts of crazy things. They just didn't understand me. And they couldn't understand. So it was their fault that I drank. I was teaching standard 9 and 10, grade 11 and 12, maths and science, teaching religion. I was sports master and I was senior boarding master. If you worked as hard as I did, you also needed to relax. And my time to relax was, after sports, they had half an hour showers. And there was a dormitory and I had my room there, and sort of a little bit down was the showers. And I would see how they were showering, and I'd go into my room, and at that time I had gin and tonics, and I would have a little tumbler of gin and tonic. I'd sneak in and have gin and tonic, and within half an hour I'd have three of them. And I thought, no, this is absolute nonsense, sneaking. And I had to hide the bottle. Every time I poured it, I had to hide the bottle. Nobody came into my room, nobody knew that. And I thought, no, I'll get clever. I will bring a beer mug upstairs, and I will pour one gin and tonic in the time that I, instead of three of them, it's wasting time. Little did I realize that soon I was having three beer mugs of gin and tonic in that same time. And after the showers, we'd go down for evening prayer. And we would be praying the Psalms. But I mean, after having a few gin and tonics, the Psalms never ever sounded as good as they did when I had those gin and tonics. I thought I was angelic in singing these Psalms and mumbling them off. And my superior would say, "Brother Douglas, have you been drinking?" No, it must be the toothpaste I'm using. I mean, I just lied. When there is a drunk lying is when his lips are moving. And I was a very good example of that. I lied, and it was, and how did I get drink? I mean, we take a vow of poverty and we don't get paid. And how did I drink? I stole the money. I was in the dormitory and I was very strict. My dormitory was neat and tidy. The boys' lockers were tidy. It was like the army. I would go and check. And if there was a shirt out, I'd pull the shirt and everything would fall, and they had to pay a fine for being untidy. And I used that fine to buy my booze. I was stealing from the kids. And I had a problem of getting rid of the bottles. That was an issue. I didn't know how to get rid of the bottles. I couldn't put them in the dustbin because the people who cleaned would see, a few bottles over there. And that was it. It was a major issue. And we lived on a property in this town, and it was 39 hectares. We had a boarding school, and it was quite big. And it was a mining town. And on the top of the property was a mine dump. And we wear habits, and I always taught in my habit. And in the habits have fairly big pockets, and they have a false pocket. So I could put my hand in my pocket and get the handkerchief out of this pocket, and I could quite easily put an atlas in one of the pockets. And how to get rid of these bottles, that was the major issue. And I devised a plan. I think the boys must have thought that I had an apparition of the Blessed Virgin at this mine dump, because I would go in my habit. I could put three bottles in this pocket and three bottles in this one, and I would have a handkerchief in this pocket and a handkerchief in that one, so that they wouldn't rattle. And to this day, I still have two handkerchiefs in my pockets. Not to keep the bottles going, but I would have my pockets in, and I would walk up to this thing. Now, I would have bottles in the pocket, not rattling. In the false pocket, I would have bottles stuck on my fingers, and I would get there, and now I had the problem to drop these bottles, so it would be gloops, and the bottles would drop there, and then I could pull and drop them out in this mine dump. And I can remember an Indian family friend. They were getting married. One of my past pupils was getting married and invited me to a wedding, and it was way out in Freiburg or somewhere that end. And I drove, and I had the bottles in the vehicle. I must have driven about 90 kilometers from the town I was in, and I had to throw the bottles away. But I didn't have a drinking problem. I didn't have a problem at all. And I can remember stopping on a bridge, getting out. Nobody knew I was looking around. Who could see me and throwing these bottles over the bridge to get rid of it? But I didn't have a drinking problem at all. I came back and, you know, I thought I had most of my moments of genius when I had had a drink. I was one of these alcoholics. One of my first sponsors told me that I fell upstairs. I didn't fall and roll down the stairs. I fell upstairs. They ended up making me principal of this private school. Now, I had access to the petty cash. And how did I do it? We would have a gala, and we'd have Mr. X and Mr. Y assisting and helping us put up the gala and doing all of it. And we had Mrs. B, who would do the buying for us. And I say, Mrs. B, Mr. X and Mr. Y have really worked very, very hard for us. Will you please get some money, just take some of the petty cash, go and buy two bottles of whiskey, and I will give it to them this evening at the function. And I knew Mrs. B wouldn't be at the gala. She would be with her family, and the bottles never got to Mr. X or Mr. Y. I would drink them. And I would go to different bottle stores, because I was afraid of people thinking that I might have a drinking problem, but I didn't have a drinking problem. I really didn't. And I would go to the bottle store. And you see, they might want to know why. I always bought two bottles of whiskey. I was a whiskey drinker. And I would have a look. That looks like a very nice cashier. I would go and choose it. And I'd say, excuse me. Do you gift wrap? Yes. And she would gift wrap the bottles for me, make it think that I'm going to give them to somebody else. I couldn't wait to get to my room to open the bottle and drink it myself. But that is how I lied and cheated to myself. I didn't have a drinking problem. I didn't have a problem. I never had a drinking problem. And that went on. If that wasn't enough, I had another fall. I didn't fall down. I fell. They made me head of the Brothers of Charity in the whole of South Africa. Ha! Now, I could sort it out. And I'd heard about geographicals. I sort of continued teaching for about 18 months while I was in that position, but it just got too much. So I moved to Johannesburg. But the move was to get run away from those old farts that I lived with. It was their fault that I drank. I would go to Johannesburg and I wouldn't drink. I got to Johannesburg and I didn't stop drinking. I used to run. I ran around Florida Lake and run everywhere. If you knew me very well, if I didn't run, you knew that I'd been drinking the night before. Because I was just too bummed out to drink. And it got worse and worse. And I decided I must do something about this drinking. I will go to Sanka. At the time, I was really, really neat and smart, and I went and I saw this lady, and I can't remember what her name was, and I convinced her that I hadn't been drinking for 7 days. I didn't need to come in for the in program. I needed the out program, and I would come in, and I religiously went for my shot in the bum for, I don't know what was it, vitamin B, and taking this anti-booze, and I religiously did it and convinced them that I didn't need the inside of it. This was coming towards the end of my drinking, and I hadn't drunk for about 8 months, and I went overseas. I went to Belgium. I used to often go to Belgium. I love going to Belgium. Oh, I'm going to jump back a bit. A story that just came to me now went to Belgium, and if I went to lived in Belgium and I had a different beer every single day of my life, I wouldn't repeat drinking a beer. They have so many beers in that place. And it was unbelievable what they could have, and they had these Trappist, you could have a triple and a double and a this and that. And I just wouldn't go for this. I would go for the triples and the duvel and the onverbore vruchte and all different names. I can tell you what beers they had. And I can remember drinking one night and having these triples, and it knocked me. And I had to go upstairs to bed. Now, all the other superiors were asleep. And the Belgians do things upside down. The doors open the wrong way. And when I open a door, it must go that way. I mustn't pull it towards me. And I had a key to open the door. And I put the key in and I unlocked it. And I couldn't open the door. I couldn't open the door. And it was a glass door. So I could see down the bottom there. And I couldn't understand. I was getting fed up with these bloody farts. They had given me the wrong bloody key, and now I can't open it. I'm trying, and it's going, and I turn. It's open, and I can't open the door. Eventually, I take the key, and I hit the glass. Dang, dang, dang. All these appears come out, and I say, this door won't open. This Indonesian brother put it down there, and he clicks it, and he opens the door. It was many embarrassing moments. My 8 months dry, I haven't had a drink, I've had Sanka. I go to Belgium and I don't touch a drink for 2 weeks. And I've got a week in Ireland. And I go to Ireland and I drive around. Guinness. And I just saw all the signs with Guinness. For a week I didn't drink. And in the evening, the Irish brothers would have a drink and they'd bring it out. No, I don't drink. I haven't drank for 8 months. But I want to experience an Irish pub. I've heard the atmosphere and all. And I go to this Irish pub and I drink soda water. And there's a lovely, fantastic atmosphere. But this Guinness, it's at the back of my head. I don't realize it's at the back of my head, this Guinness. The last night, the brothers bring out J&B, a bottle of J&B. I think, oh, I'm just going to have one. When I went to bed, there was 3/4 of the bottle finished. I don't think I finished 3/4 of it, but I must have had most of it. And the next morning, none of us woke up for morning prayers. And I had a headache, and I had to catch the plane. And I said to the guys, listen, for security reasons or this and that, I have to get to the airport about 2 hours beforehand. Just drop me there. That's it. I wanted to taste this Guinness. They didn't have Guinness in the house. I wanted to taste it. I get to the airport. I've got my bags, and I don't know why I didn't go through the checkout or anything, and that the only time I can ever remember drinking in a bar, I never ever drank in a bar. I was one of these closet drinkers, drank at home or whatever. And in this bar, I'm drinking, and I don't know why I had to open my hand luggage. When I opened my hand luggage, I had too many clothes. I couldn't put them all back together. I had to buy a second hand luggage to put some of the stuff that had overflowed out of there. I don't know how I got through customs. I got through that. I got on the plane, and I met a little old lady there, and a little old lady there, and 3 old ladies. And I don't know how I charmed them or whatever it was. And during the meal, each little old lady got a bottle of red wine. Down the aisle and gave me my bottle of red wine, so that the air hostesses didn't think that I was drinking too much. And so I would just have one bottle of wine, but the 3 little ladies were giving me bottles of wine through, I don't know how I got through customs in South Africa. And it was in December, 1997. And I realized just for the first time, there's something wrong with my drinking. Very serious. I knew it many, many years before. But I was too scared to go home for Christmas, because if the family saw how I drink, it would be a disaster. So I said to them, now I've been overseas and I've got just too much work to do, I'm not coming home. And the reason I didn't want to go home is because if I had a drink over Christmas, I don't know when I would have stopped. I didn't drink over Christmas, I didn't drink over New Year. I was very good. And one of the old brothers, Brother Gaston, said, I cook meat very well. And he had said, would you do a roast for us? I said, yes, so I'll cook the roast. And I prepared everything and I said, I need some red wine. He said, oh yes, there's a 5 liter. No, I need special red wine. But this head of mine already clicked. I needed some whiskey. This is an opportunity to have a drink. So I had to go and get some red wine at the bottle store. Off I went with my briefcase. 2 gift wrap bottles of whiskey. Back. Go to my room, put it down. I get back into the kitchen and, ooh, I've forgotten the special red wine that's going to make this. Now, all of a sudden, the 5 liters were good enough for me. I used that, and I snuck off to my room to have a drink. And I can remember putting the meat into the oven. I cannot remember taking it out. I cannot remember eating it. I ended up in that room, drinking, waking up, drinking. I had locked myself up. I was the superior. And I said, no, I've got gastro. Just leave me alone. But that wasn't true. I'd ended up closing the curtains and locked myself into a room. And I can remember the shakes and shivers and lying in my bed, 2 o'clock in the morning, the Saturday morning. And the thought, the only way out of this mess is to die. It was the first time suicide came into my mind. And I cried out, God, help me. I didn't have Donner and Blixem and lightning and the rest of it coming out and that, but the thing was, get to a rehab. And I couldn't wait until, and I don't know why in my mind rehab opened at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, and I had to phone. But I wanted nothing to do with AA. I wanted to get this sorted out and get on with my life. Why did I want nothing to do with AA? 7 years earlier, I had been on a retreat in Northern Natal, and the guy who was giving us a retreat, a priest, he was quite unbelievable for me. He was talking about AA, and in AA they say this, and sounded quite wise of what they were saying, and I thought, this is a good guy. He's studied these AAs and he's learned something from his hopeless bloody cases. That's quite something. And when I had my private interview with him, I spoke to him, I said, I think I drink too much. Well, I could have a drinking problem. He said, no problem. Tonight there's a meeting. We'll go to the meeting. Okay. Not bad. And we picked up our sister Pathanusia and sister this one or that one, and we were a load of religious hope. Now we're going to get to this place and we're going to listen to Father tell these bloody drunks and that how to drink properly and behave themselves. That's what we're going to do. We're going to teach them a lesson. We're sitting there. We got into this room. They were all bloody alcoholics. Those were drunks. I was not a drunk. I was quite fine. There was nothing wrong with me. But these guys, there was one guy, I can remember, he had been out for 6 weeks and his ear was almost half falling off, and he'd come in looking like, I don't know what, and we're going in, back, clap, clap. I thought, God, these are bloody mad. They are nuts. And they talk around the corner. Graham, and I'm now calling you. And everyone going around, and Father sitting next to me, his side, and it's going around. And it comes to him. Now he's going to tell them. He says, hi, I'm Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. This guy that I admire, I couldn't close my jaw when it came to me. I couldn't even say pass. I couldn't close. I thought, I'm getting out of this. This is bloody nonsense. This is nonsense. I'll sort this out. And I was just against everything. And I can remember driving back and saying, I'll sort this out myself. And for 7 years, I was in misery and loneliness. took me another 7 years before I had the courage to go back to AA. I didn't want anything to do with AA, and I go to rehab. The first rehab I phone, it didn't sound so good. Yellow pages. Second one, didn't sound so good either. The third one, the guy sounded really nice. And I said, all right, I'm going to come in there. I'm coming there. And I go down at 20 past 7, and we're there, and I tell the brother, I tell poor old little brother Gaston, I said to him, brother, I'm going into a rehab. I can't handle this. He said, I'll be praying for you. The little fella, he supports me. And at breakfast, I break my tooth. So I have to phone them and tell them, listen, I first have to go to the dentist, and I'll be there at 2 o'clock. And I think the guy thought, this guy's never going to come in. And they took me in on a Saturday. I walk in, and there are the 12 steps and the traditions and all. And I thought, what is it? And I had to have my head stuck in, because I would have rewritten the book. I would have sorted it all out. And I'm in rehab. I'm a bit different to these. They are drug addicts and they are alcoholics. You can see them, and I'm not quite the same. So I was a gentleman drinker in my mind. I didn't quite have the problems they have. And after about a week, they wanted to kick me out. But how they must have planned it quite well. And we're in a group, and there's a counselor sitting there and a counselor here and knowing. And for me, women speak well and they don't swear. And they had this counselor, and she said to me, what are you doing here? And I said, listen, I am an alcoholic. I booked myself in here. Nobody sent me to come here. And I'm getting myself sorted out here. Well, you should get that out of here. And she was swearing and using unbelievable and told me to get that out of this place until I was honest with myself, because I'm wasting my time and their time and I couldn't believe it. And that woke me up. Thank God for her. Because then I started realizing that I was no different to the others. And that I had a problem and I had to face it. And I went to a meeting in Rosebank. That was my first meeting. And they had said to us, yeah, those of you who have for the first time, please just stand up and give your first name. I wanted to stand up and say, I'm Peter and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't want to say, that's how sick I was. And anyway, I was too terrified to drink again. And they told me, when you get out of rehab, you must have a sponsor. And there was a guy in that place, give me a scorpion farm and so. And I wanted a sponsor. The guy that I wanted was this guy. But I was so afraid of rejection that if I went to ask him and he said, no, I'm not going to sponsor you. So I went to him and I told him what characteristics I wanted in a sponsor. And I was trying to make out that I'm really praising him and that he would say, oh, yes, I'll sponsor you. He said, no, I've got the guy for you, that guy. Well, that guy had long hair and it was just no match between us. No match between us. But I was too scared not to drink. And he changed his name and he added little prefixes and suffixes to his name and all. But I was too scared not to drink and I would do whatever they told me. So I went and I said, please, will you sponsor me? And he sponsored me and he did help me very much. And anyway, I changed sponsors eventually and I managed to stay sober. But those guys in Rosebank were very unfriendly. They were not very nice guys. And they were alcoholics, and I was only coming there because my sponsor told me to go there, and I was going to get sober, and within 2 weeks or so, I'd sorted out and lived my own life. I had to go down to Lesotho for a function, and they told me about Mr. Slick talking on my ear, and I went down, and I had to phone my sponsor because I almost wanted to drink down there, and he assisted to help me. An unbelievable miracle happened in the week that I was away in Lesotho. All these people in Rosebank, they changed. When I got back, they were so nice. They were wonderful people. My sponsor told me, you stupid fool, it's you that's changed. And things have happened. The miracle has happened is that I'm sober today. And I'm grateful. Those old fellas in Rosebank, somewhere they told me, you come here. You need God. We're not going to discuss who God is or what God is. You need God. And that was the most difficult thing for me. I'd been in religion for 24 years. And I had to change my concept of God to a loving, caring God. And that is where my life changed. And I'm just extremely grateful to be alive today. It is not always, you know, I still can blow my top and do this and that, but I can admit where I'm wrong and go and try and sort it out. And those old farts that I lived with were the best thing that ever happened in my life, in that they really, they prayed for me and they cared for me. I was the wildest. I mean, my superior and I, when I was a young brother, we always argued whenever I had something to drink, because I believed I told the truth. And I just am so embarrassed of what I have done. But thank goodness for this program that I can sort those things out. And I am most grateful to be part of the fellowship and something that helps me change. And part of my work every day is to grow spiritually. That's what I have to do. That is, I have to try and be the best person that my higher power that I choose to call God has made. And he doesn't make junk. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.